Greetings, my friend, and welcome to Beyond Curious. Conversations with brave adventurers like yourself that are taking voyages into the unknown to satisfy their curiosity, fulfill their purpose, and bring their ideas to life. My name is Brandon Fong, and I am so grateful for you. Whether this is your very first time listening or you are coming back week after week, I appreciate you so much for being here, and I'm beyond excited to introduce you to today's guest, Mark Podolsky.
People are calling me up and saying, Mark, it's between making this land payment or food. Food wins. And 50% of my income is gone. But I had Parkinson's law of money. So the more money I made, the more money I spent trying to chase this feeling of being enough. And that's when I really realized, oh my gosh, this stuff is really not making me happy.
Guys, if you couldn't tell from that story, this is a good one. We get to dive into the journey of an entrepreneur that has made a massive impact, developed a ton of passive income to sustain a life that he wants, and it was a hard-earned journey. He had to go through some stuff, as you heard from that quote. So who are we hanging out with today? Let me tell you a little bit about Mark. Mark is the owner of Frontier Properties, a land investment company. Mark is known as the land geek, and he is widely considered the country's most trusted and foremost authority on buying and selling raw, undeveloped land within the United States. In other words, he has made a ton of money selling dirt. He's the author of Dirt Rich: How One Ambitiously Lazy Geek Created Passive Income in Real Estate Without Renters, Renovations, and Rehabs, and he's also the host of the Art of Passive Income podcast, which has over 4.5 million downloads. And shout out to our mutual friend, Mr. Charles Bird, for this incredible introduction. Charles, I appreciate you so much. Guys, this is a ton of fun in this episode, not only because we have somebody that got curious about dirt and made an entire career out of it and also helping people to do that as well. So there's so much to look forward to in today's conversation, but I would love for you to look out for three specific things. Number one, how Mark went from arguing with his wife about not being able to afford organic baby food to making $800,000 a year selling raw land to crashing and then having to rebuild in a much more fulfilling yet still profitable way. Number two, Mark's five-step system that he uses to create passive income in real estate without renters, renovations, and rehabs. And number three, this came at the very end, Mark revealed his triple P formula for happiness that he actually made up specifically for being on Beyond Curious. I really love that. So this is an incredible conversation. Mark is an awesome dude. Really looking forward to continuing the conversation with him. So without any further ado, please enjoy this conversation with my new friend, Mr. Mark Podolsky. Mark, my friend, oh my gosh, my Beyond Curious human, we're going to be talking about dirt, we're going to be talking about your adventure, it's going to go all over the place. Super excited to have you here, this is going to be a blast, my friend.
Brandon, so glad to be here, brother. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. I thought a great place to start would be talking about organic baby food. let's rewind back the clock. It's 2001. You're in a really interesting spot in your life. So talk to us a little bit about what was going on at that time and maybe conversations that you were having about your wife about baby food.
Okay. This is hilarious. Talk about doing your research. So I don't know how many of these podcasts I've done, but no one's ever asked me about the organic baby food story. But okay. Certainly I was a stressed out investment banker. And my parents, I grew up very frugal. My dad was a wholesale grocer and he knew the price of everything. And so this is just the way I was raised. I knew the prices of everything in the grocery store. My wife at the time, we're divorced now, she grew up the opposite, right? Like opposites attract. And so she really wasn't interested in a good deal at all. She wanted what she wanted and that was cool. But I thought, well, look, it's an extra dollar for organic baby food. Like, I don't get it. Like, let's save the money on the puree here and get regular baby food. And this was actually an argument about, it wasn't about the baby food, it was about values. What do we really value in life? How do we really want to spend our money? How do we think about money? And you know, looking back on it, it seems so silly, but when I was in that scarcity mode and seeing, okay, I get this paycheck, I get this commission, I pay this much in taxes, I want to invest this much, like, and say, okay, wait, that just seems like a waste of money. Let's,
Yeah.
you know, I'm going to hold my ground on organic baby food.
So let's dig in more into like what was going on in your life then. I also want to ask a question about your dad and the wholesale grocer thing, because I think there's something interesting there that I'm just kind of curious about. But like, just set the scene, because this is before you set out on your hero's journey of the investing, and just maybe kind of paint the picture about like what your job was like kind of what you were facing on a day-to-day reality that really kind of set you up to really want to make sure that you change things.
So if we rewind the tape to 2000, I was a miserable, micromanaged 45-minute commute to work and back investment banker, specializing in mergers and acquisitions with private equity groups. And Brandon, it got so bad for me. I wouldn't get the Sunday blues anticipating Monday coming around. I'd get the Friday blues anticipating the weekend going by really fast and having to be back at work on Monday. And so, you know, coming from this feeling of I hate my job, I want to, you know, every dollar is precious. It was just, I was not happy. I was
Yeah.
just not happy professionally.
And I think so many people can hear that and relate to it, but like so many people just continue to slog on with that going on. But obviously, that is not the you're not still doing investment banking, cold calling, and arguing about baby food anymore. You've been on a slightly different journey since then. So I know there was kind of like a pivotal moment of having a conversation with someone where you ended up writing like a note on the back of a bar napkin that kind of introduced this whole concept of investing in land and doing some of that kind of stuff. So maybe like take us to that point. Like, what was that conversation that initially got you interested in this whole world that you're like the foremost authority on right now?
So my buddy, who was also doing investment banking with me, he was buying and selling raw land. He was going to tax deed auctions and he was flipping land. He was making a 300% return on his investment. And he was a Scotch guy. I was a Scotch guy. And we went to this bar and we started telling me over a drink what he was doing as a side hustle. And he was drawing it out on the napkin. And I'm thinking to myself, well, I'm looking at companies all day long. And a great company, great. Has 15% EBITDA margins or free cash flow. Average company's 10%. I'm looking at companies all day long, less than 10%. So I don't believe him. And so we go to New Mexico together. I've got $3,000 saved for car repairs. And I just did exactly what he told me to do. I bought 10 half-acre parcels, an average price of $300 each. I flipped them online and they all sold for an average price of $1,200 each. It worked 300%. So I took all that money and I went to another auction. This is in Arizona. Again, it's 2000. There's no one in the room. And I'm buying up lots and acreage for like nothing. And I sold all that land. I made over $90,000 cash. So I go to my wife, she's pregnant at the time. I said, honey, I'm going to quit my job and become a full-time land investor. And she said, absolutely not. So I said, okay. So it took 18 months for the land investing income to exceed the investment banking income. And then I quit and I've been doing it full time ever since.
So I want to zoom into that first transaction, kind of like what was going on in your head, 'cause like as you know, we started by talking about baby food, obviously. So you were considering money and having your last $3,000 in savings. I'm sure that was no that didn't come across as an easy thing for you to do. And I'm sure there was like conversations that you had with your wife, and as any entrepreneur that's done anything, we've had to go through these big leap situations, to use Gay Hendricks' term, where it's like you have to make the commitment and kind of see what happens. But it's not a fun feeling going through it until you're kind of used to it. But like, maybe talk us through a little bit more of like that first transaction, because like if anybody's considering making a big move or making a jump or switching into a new business venture, I feel like just understanding other people's perspectives that have gone through this and made those jumps is really, really powerful. So maybe talk a little bit about like emotionally how you handled that and some of the conversations you had to have with your wife during that period of putting your last $3,000 in savings into something.
It's so funny. I mean, this is before I think even the 4-hour work week and Tim Ferriss and his fear setting exercise. I did my own fear setting exercise. And so I walked through with my wife, what's the worst case scenario with this $3,000? And we literally just wrote it down. So I said, okay, here's the worst case scenario. I can't sell it. The money's gone, but we own raw land. So what does that look like? Well, you know, you're not going to get mad at me. There's no boxes in the garage, right? So there's nothing physical here for to be upset about. And then there's nothing I need to go out and maintain or protect. Here, it's just dirt, right? So I don't have to spend any extra money maintaining it, protecting it, improving it, anything like that. So I'm limited now to $3,000. The annual taxes are $9, no problem, right? So even if it takes a year to sell, we can handle the tax situation. And then I said, okay, well, just because I can't sell it doesn't mean it has no value. What if I could barter it? What if I could just go to my dentist or my barber and get, you know, free dentistry or free haircuts for a year? Like I could do that. So I have something that's valuable, relatively valuable to someone else, even if I can't go online and sell it, even if I'm just terrible at this. And I'm not going to really disrupt our lives in any way. So the worst case scenario was barter. And even if I couldn't barter it, then the worst case scenario was don't pay the property taxes, let it go for taxes and apply for what they call an overage. So if it goes for over what the property tax amount was, I still get that money. And it just seemed like this is stupid. Like there's so little risk compared to everything else I could have been doing.
No, I love that. And I think it's so, this is actually just my personal experience, is like whenever you're considering making a jump into something else, like our brains automatically just forecast the word. It's like, I call it like a doom loop, right? Like you start thinking about, oh, like, well, all about this. And then it's like, you start digging up all your childhood trauma and then all of a sudden you're just in a really bad mood. But I find, like, I love that. And too, if anybody's listening, and they haven't seen Tim Ferriss's TED talk, which you're referring to on fear setting. I just think I love what you shared there. I had one of these days where I was just pissed off the other day. It doesn't happen that often, but I was just like, why don't I just sit and why don't I just write it all down? Because I feel like when you're just going through that conversation in your head over and over and over again, it just, you end up just mentally punching yourself over and over. But when you write it down on a piece of paper, it's like, okay, I can handle that. It's not that bad. And like, it sounds like you did too. It's like, if you can come to terms with that worst case scenario and still be living to fight another day and surviving, I think that is a really powerful way to make sure that you're mitigating that. Is this yeah. something that
are,
you
are you a journaler, Brandon? I'm just curious.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Okay. So when do you journal?
It depends on what kind of journaling practice you're talking about. Cause I've been doing gratitude journaling. This is the year of abundant gratitude for me. So I've been writing 10 things down. This started out as last year. I did 10 things a day that I appreciated about my wife as a birthday gift to her. So I could give that to her. So it's really cool. But I started doing that now into 2024. And then I also do monthly journaling. I do quarterly journaling and I do end of year journaling where I'm kind of reflecting on everything. So it kind of depends on which practice you're talking about, but there's different versions of it.
Okay. You're very advanced. You're very advanced journaling. So, I've always tried to do journaling. I tried to do morning pages. For those of you that don't know what morning pages is, it's just you write three pages, just stream of consciousness. And I found it very helpful, especially when I was going through my divorce, just to get that sort of inner curmudgeon out of me and onto paper. And so, but then it didn't stick for whatever reason. And I would try the gratitude journal and even like what that gratitude piece, like 10 a day, that's insane. So that's 3,650 reasons you're grateful for your wife. Like what a gift. So, but even more, I think is the gift for you because I know you're a big happiness guy. I think we're not, grateful because we're happy. I think we're happy because we're grateful.
100%.
And so, but even for me, like I would do this gratitude thing, and it was just checking off the box, like, and it was like this OCD way, like, okay, grateful for my health, I'm grateful for my kids' health, I'm grateful for, you know, whatever, right? Pick the thing, like, you know, I have a roof over my head. But then when I started getting really meta about it day to day, and then it, like, oh my gosh, this is there's like an abundance of things to be grateful for.
Yeah.
And like, but we just don't look for it. And I think that it's a game changer when you're just like, you know, like you're not even entitled to your next breath.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, even just to be doing this, right? And that the internet is stable and it's not crashing and it's not choppy. And to have a real conversation and a meaningful, connected conversation, people could go a whole year not having that.
Yeah.
And we're doing it now in real time. So, but getting back to the journaling is that I've started it and I find that I'm writing my fears out in the morning and I'm sort of combining, like, here's what I did yesterday. So I do it in the morning and then here's what's going on. And here's what I'm thinking about. Here's what I'm afraid of. Here's what I want to work on. And it's just giving clarity and getting that doom loop out of my head. I love that
too. Yeah. Yeah. No, I had another guest, Jen Drummond, referred to it as a grump dump. Sometimes you just got to do a grump dump, which I thought was pretty fun too. I also, I just joined, Yannick Silver's Maverick Next group. And he talks about, journaling with your left hand to access your subconscious. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. It's funny, 'cause I have some left-handed journaling on my wall right now, but it is interesting when you kind of force yourself to slow down. And one other thing I'll say on this thing too, about gratitude, what I found is that when you do 10, 'cause I feel like some people do 3 or 5, like you hit the big things with 3 or 5, but then after you go beyond 3 or 5, you really have to start looking for stuff. And what I found is that the gratitude practice is not in the writing it down. The gratitude practice is the fact that you have to do 10 so that in the moment when you're experiencing something small, you think about it and you're like, oh, maybe I'll write this down tomorrow as something that I have to do, right? Like, and it could be something super small. Like yesterday I went on a walk with my three month old and I got to gave her a snowball for the first time. And like, that was just super special, you know, just like watch her, like, what the heck is this thing, you know? But it's like, it's those teeny little things that, like, I don't know, if you just start to notice it a lot more when you have to go to 10 is my experience, because you have to look for the small things after you run out of the big things after 3. So thank you for nerding out on journaling with me.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. But I mean, I think, you know, nerding out on gratitude is one of those just things that really can move the needle in someone's life.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to follow this track, because I think this is really interesting. I wanted to ask you about this and you kind of brought it up with your dad. So it's like, I'm going to massage this to make this all fit linearly, because another function of journaling is like uncovering components of yourself that may not be serving you anymore, right? Or like these things that you're starting to observe. And I saw in your book, there was another story where you had mentioned gum, where you were, your dad yelled at you for buying a piece of gum because so I don't know if you want to share that story, but what I was curious about asking about is, actually, you know what? Let me just ask that story and then I'm going to ask my follow-up question, because then I'm getting too far ahead of myself and this is going to fit together, I promise. So talk to us a little bit about that gum story where you're with your dad and he got mad at you about making a particular purchase.
Yeah. I mean, I think my dad's the one that made me into a deal junkie, because he was a wholesale grocer. He knew the prices of everything. And we're in the grocery store. I'm like, Dad, can I, you know how the kids are in the line. Like, hey, can I get this piece of gum? He's like, no, it's $1 or whatever it was at the time. He's like, I get this for 75 cents. And it was just like, I was like, wait, oh, you can get that. Okay. Like, fine. It's like, all right, it's your dad. I mean, no kid likes to be told no, but then you're thinking, wait, you can get a deal on this?
Yeah. So thank you for sharing. So this is where I wanted to go with this, because like you've turned it into a superpower, right? Like this is like you literally, like, this is part of your superpower, is like finding these deals and being good about pricing, that kind of stuff. But like, I resonated with that story so much, because like growing up, that was like, even if you talk to my parents today, like they love a good deal. They love going to Menards and getting the whatever's on rebate and all that kind of stuff, or whatever deal they got. Like, it's a frequent topic of conversation. So it's like, it can serve you and it has served you. But there's also like a scarcity kind of like non-abundance mindset that's associated with that. So this is where I was kind of going with the journaling, is I'm curious to hear if that perspective of like making sure that you're always getting for the good deal, if that has also at the same time, it's been a superpower if it's hindered you in some ways. And if so, how you've been able to kind of manage the negative side of that programming.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, Brandon, I've been in 14 years of therapy. So okay. this is something I really had to work on and change the neural networks in my brain, because I grew up, you know, a little deprived, you know, scarcity mentality. I was a huge Star Wars kid, and, you know, growing up in it, I remember I could get like four figurines, and I'm like, wait, I want Boba Fett. Like, and I remember my mom saying to me, no, your dad's having a bad year. So like, wait, what?
Boba Fett. You only get a Yoda this year.
yeah. I didn't even get Yoda. I got like Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker.
Sarlacc, like the Sarlacc figurine or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Like, so I'm like, so I can't get these things because, you know, these parents are like, there's things going on outside of my control. And so even like, I think I started a lemonade company. I was 11. I started selling cookies door to door when I was 12. I became like I had the corsage monopoly in high school. If you wanted to go to prom or homecoming, I locked up all the florists. So if you wanted to get them an order, you just ordered through me.
What?
And so yeah.
wait. Hold on. That had to derail you. How did this work? Like, you had to call the florist and you bought out all their.
I just said, look, you know, yeah, exactly. I said, look, I'm gonna take all the orders for you. You guys don't need to, go and advertise or market or do anything. I'm gonna save you all the time. I'm gonna control the market. I'll get you guys so many of these things, but you have to order like through me. And they're like, okay. And so they would call, like, you have to go through Mark.
Okay, so I don't want to derail where you were going with it, but this is just too good to not ask about. So how much did you upchart? Did you like double the price of them, or like how masochistic were you on your monopoly?
Well, I was a high schooler kid. I mean, I remember making thousands of dollars doing it. I don't remember the floor sets to like control of that too. Like, you can't upcharge too much. But I mean, so if I wanted things, I had learned at a really early age, like, I have to go out and figure out how to get them. My dad would bring home a case of Snickers bars for the family. And, you know, if you're used to it, like, you don't need a Snickers bars. Like, they don't have them in the vending machine. I would sell them for a dollar.
Hmm.
And so I just learned, like, okay, I like a deal. And if I want something, I've got to go hustle and get it.
Yeah.
Because my parents were going to give it to me, which, looking back, was a great gift. And I think that, and I was listening to a Morgan Housel interview, it's one of the worst things you can do for your kids is just, you know, because then they don't understand. He's like, now that sort of changes in their 30s and 40s, where they really do need the money. And, you know, it really can help them. Absolutely help your kids then. But you're doing them a disservice if they don't understand the value of the money and how to go out and make it.
Yeah, this could easily turn into like a therapy session for me as well. I feel like we have a very similar, because it's like when I grew up, like, my brother and I really wanted a Wii, but like my parents wouldn't, you know, it was expensive to get the Wii or whatever. So like we sold our Pokemon cards. We, you know, I don't remember, like, I think, oh, that was another thing too, is I had to pay for my own contacts. So it's like I had glasses that like I didn't like, but if I had to figure out how to pay for contacts, I had to go figure out whatever it was too. So it's like, that scrappiness has absolutely served me. But like, as it sounds like you've done in your therapy as well, like, there's like caps that it puts on your mindset as well. I think I use Gay Hendricks's term already, but it's like he calls it an upper limit problem, right? It's like you hit that level where your brain is like comfortable with stuff, and then you freak out, and then you manifest some kind of crazy thing to kind of create a crash. So I mean, that's just like me speaking a little bit, just how much I resonate with that, because there's definitely like the positive side that made you who you are, but then there's like the limitation where it caps out that you have to go back and redo some of the work on it.
No, absolutely. Like, nobody's gonna ride for free. And so yeah, it's just like it's like there's like, if you're a superhero, like, this is our kryptonite, right? It's like,
yeah,
this serves us, but then okay, but then at a certain point it no longer serves us. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what I've been working on. I still work on it every day, is having that abundance mentality. And really, I think for me, like, meditation has been the single biggest mover for abundance. When I can just drop in and B, that silence and that feeling. I mean, I sort of get this euphoric feeling. It's like there's nothing out there that is ever going to satisfy me. It's a totally internal game. And once you feel that and see that, it changes everything. Like it's hard to, it's sort of like an ineffable experience. But I think that's for me where I got to this abundance mentality and realizing that there's a lot of, I like the game and I like to strive, but I'm not attached to it.
That's special. And
I have everything I need.
I love that. And I love that you have the meditation practice. Admittedly, I've been kind of falling off on that, but like, as I've just kind of watched my daughter, it's like the radical presence that a baby or a dog has, you know, it's just like, there's nothing outside of the present moment. And I feel like that's kind of like what you're describing, is at least from what I've kind of just watched Kaya and back when I was more into meditating. But it's like, you're just so connected to source. You lose that sense of like, you know, your consciousness, you're not your body that's sitting inside this reality, right? You're just kind of connected to everything. So that's super cool. Mark, I want to bridge. I think there's an interesting spot to like kind of bridge back to part of your story, is because we were kind of talking about this little bit of self-sabotage that happens as we continue to go. So, I mean, we were just talking about before we took this amazing detour, which I love this, but like, you know, you were talking about like you eventually got into land flipping, and we can obviously unpack some of that as well. But like, eventually, you know, you're crushing it. You were far from where you were, and you still are, but like far from where you were in 2000, 2001, worrying about organic baby food. So talk to us a little bit more about around 2010, you kind of build it up, kind of the lifestyle you were living there. And I heard there was you had an interesting experience that kind of caused you to reassess everything again there. So I would love for you to share that if you'd be open.
Yeah, the gift of the Great Recession. Yeah. So I'm making lots of money between 2001 and 2010. Like, I really didn't get hit until 2010, even the Great Recession hits in 2008. But my company is still making money, and actually it's still profitable even during the Great Recession. But because of the way I grew up and hearing from my parents, like, this is success. And they would sort of have these, they would admire these certain people in our community, and they all had, you know, big cars and big houses. And I'm like, oh, this is, I've got the money, I'm going to get that. And then I'm going to feel like I'm enough. Right. So I go and I do it. So I get the big house. I'm not even a car guy, but I, you know, caused all my neighbors, I had a Camry that was paid off, but all my neighbors had nice luxury cars. So I'm like, okay, that's not good enough. So I got a luxury car. And then, you know, I've got three kids. And public school, no, private school. And even though my wife didn't work, nanny, no problem. But then the house is still a mess, and the nanny's not cleaning up. So we got the housekeeper. So, you know, nanny full-time, housekeeper full-time, and I'm building up all this personal overhead. And then suddenly it was like one day, because, you know, I'm owner financing this land, and people are calling me up and saying, Mark, it's between making this land payment or food wins. And 50% of my income is gone. But I had Parkinson's law of money. So the more money I made, the more money I spent trying to chase this feeling of being enough. And that's when I really realized, oh my gosh, you know, this stuff is really not making me happy. But I had, you know, I had to go through the ego kick of, you know, getting rid of that house. I had to go rent a home. You know, I went from like 4,500 square feet to 1,700 square feet. Public school, had to disappoint the kids. You know, cut down like on all these expenses. Like, we would be going out for big dinners, like on a Tuesday night, and getting a babysitter. You know how much babysitters are, and doing all that. And so that was gone. And next thing you know, it's like, oh my gosh, we're playing charades with the kids, and I'm so much happier. I have less pressure. I'm spending quality time with my children, and I'm realizing, like, oh my gosh, there was all that stuff out there was actually, not only was it not making me happy, it was making me unhappy. and trying to get this, I guess, you know, I don't know if it was my parents' approval, it was outside people's approval. Like, look at me, I'm successful, but I didn't ever felt successful. I really felt successful after it all went away. And it kind of got that ego kick in the head. And to this day, I think it stayed with me for sure. And I've learned that lesson. There's nothing wrong with those things, by the way. I think they're all great. There's nothing wrong with them. I just don't think they're going to make you happy. And I think I was chasing, you know, when I get all this, then I'll be happy.
That's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. I think that's just, everybody learns through other people's stories, right? So like, hopefully we just saved a few people from the misery that happens when you're, I never heard of the Parkinson's law of money put that way. So that, I love that that's a part of the language now, but I want to kind of zoom in on like the, cause there's a point when you hit the rock bottom where you don't understand what the lesson is. And then there's the point where you understand the lesson. And then there's that period in between those two things that just suck, right? So like what, talk to us a little bit about like, you literally moved from that massive home with all these luxury cars to a rented home with all these small things. So like, if somebody's listening to this and they're going through that period, or if you're an entrepreneur and you just are growing, something like this is inevitably going to happen. Like talk to, like any words of wisdom for that period, like how you, like, what was that mental dialogue and how did you kind of start working your way towards that before you started having the realization and all the kind of stuff? Any insights from that chunk there?
Yeah. I mean, I think I was just going through it and realizing that as I was stretching my resilience muscles, nothing of any major consequence was happening in my life. The kids had enough food. We had a roof over our heads. Our needs were being met, more than our needs were being met. And it was just really realizing as I was going through it that I have to do things differently. I have to be just better at what I do and figure this out. Like I've got this new problem to solve. And in a way, I remember thinking just here's a new challenge to solve. It's just another problem to solve. And I didn't at some point, and it might have been, maybe therapy helped me with it too. There was a lot of self-esteem to be had that I was doing it, where a lot of people were living a lie out here in 2008. They stayed in their house and just stopped paying their mortgage. I could have done the same thing and just let the bank chase me. I'm like, no, I'm not going to do that. Like, I'm going to live in reality. I'm not going to act like I can afford this house when I can't afford this house. I'm not going to act like I can afford these things when I can't afford it. I'm going to live in reality and just sort of this more value-based approach to life. And less egoic. Yeah, it sucked going through it. But then at some point, yeah, you're right. You get to the other side of it. I don't think I was ever really aware of those major inflection points in my life because it was just happening so quickly.
Yeah,
it's more looking at it, what, 10 plus years later, really.
Yeah. So it's really just more of like
14 years later.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just moving through it. Yeah. I mean, think about like your dad and the newborn baby and, you know, those tough nights and not sleeping and but you survive it. Right.
Yeah. One day at a time, I feel like is kind of like the motto in those experiences too. Not that, I mean, although Kaya got her hands free, we were experimenting with outside of the sleep snuggie, or what do you call that thing? The thing that Velcro straps them in. We're letting her arms loose now. So she was whacking herself in the head and waking herself up last night. So that was my night last night, but I totally get it. So I want to go into like the other side of that experience is like, you had this realization of like this playing charades with your family, like was like really meaningful. And so as I saw from your book, you kind of started to really start doubling down on experiences after you kind of came towards that. So maybe share, I would love for you to share maybe just some of the ways that you spend meaningful time with your family now and some of the ways that you're investing in your lifestyle now has kind of empowered you to see that side of things instead of more of the material side of things.
Yeah. I mean, last year I traveled to 16 countries. I took my parents who are for their 80th birthdays on a European cruise. You know, my kids are older now, so I'm an empty nester. But I definitely think that experiences are where it's at. And there's a great book by, I think it's Bill Perkins, Die with Zero. And paying that, you know, those experiences pay dividends for sure. So I've been to Bali. I went on African safari, Vietnam, you know, all over Africa, Botswana, Zambia, Zimbabwe. You know, the safaris, and then just traveling just constantly, has been so rewarding because when I go and I do the, it's like I do like a morning breath work, you know, based on gratitude, I can just close my eyes and see, these amazing experiences and the waterfalls and the animals and talk about having gratitude. I mean, there's literally a billion people on this planet that would consider their lives, you know, greatest dreams come true to be any one of us. If you're listening to this podcast, you are in the top 1% in the world. And so, but you don't see it day to day because of where you live. It's like, we're constantly comparing about this small little place that we have, but you go to Africa and you see a thatched roof made of elephant dung and termite mound. And that's someone's life and they're surviving. It's an incredible feeling of just gratitude for what you have.
Yeah. Very, very eye-opening. And just kind of, I got a friend, Randy Mullen, that's coming on the show. I don't know if you met Randy. He'd be a cool guy for you to connect with. But he's got a company called Go Big to Give Big. And I think it's just like those travel experiences where you really get to experience and step out of that bubble. Not only have I found that those have been really insightful for me and my thinking, just kind of like shake things up. Like when you don't know how to buy toothpaste when you're traveling anymore because you can't read the damn label. You have to kind of like rethink everything. You're not on autopilot anymore. But yeah, no, I love that. And the fact that you've been able to build this life where you've doubled down on those experiences. So I know we've kind of been like teasing this whole time. We kind of talked a little bit about the land beforehand and like what this like investment in this business has helped support you with and these experiences that you have. So I'm sure some people are like, okay, like let's talk about this dude sells raw land. Like what is this? So I think it'd be great to maybe talk a little bit about some of the foundations that you talk about in your book, which by the way, anybody can go check out Dirt Rich, How One Ambitiously Lazy Geek, AKA the amazing Mark Podolsky that I'm talking to you right now, created passive income in real estate without renters, renovations and rehabs, and termites and toilets, I think is another part that you use. That's not in the subtitle. I'm adding that, but I think it'd be great to kind of maybe set some foundations of what you've been able to do and why investing in land has been so perfect for you. So I think maybe a great place to start, and you can say, no, that's not a good place to start. We can start somewhere else. But I love in your book, you talk about your friend Raj, you and him were kind of trying to debate what a dream perfect business would be like. And it seems like dirt has filled a lot of that for you. So we'd love you to maybe share that insight and a little bit about why land is just something that you found to be one of the best models that has helped support you in living this life that you want to live.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the way that my model works is we're making our money on the buy and then we're flipping it. We're getting our money out on a down payment and then we're owner financing the rest. And so we're playing this game. Can we create enough land notes where our passive income exceeds our fixed expenses? But because it's raw land, we don't have to deal with any renters, rehabs, renovations, or rodents. And so, Brand, if you think it's helpful for the listener, I can actually walk them step by step on how to even do this model.
Let's do it.
Okay, so Brandon, where do you live?
Wisconsin.
Wisconsin. Okay, so I'm going to assume that you own 5 acres of raw land in where I live in Arizona, but you owe $200 in back taxes. So you're advertising two important things to me. Number one, you have no emotional attachment to the raw land. You're in Wisconsin, the property's in Arizona. And number two, you're distressed some weird way financially because we don't pay for things like our property taxes. We don't value them in the same way. As a result, the county treasurer keep sending you notices saying, Brandon, if you don't pay your property taxes, you're going to lose that property to a tax deed or a tax lien investor. So all I'm going to do is look at your 5-acre parcel where I live, and I'm going to look at the comparable sales for the last 12 to 18 months. And I'm going to take the lowest comparable sale. Let's say it's $10,000. And then I'm going to divide by 4. And that's going to get me what Warren Buffett would call a 300% margin of safety. So I'm going to send you an actual offer of $2,500. Now, if you have other real estate people listening to this, they probably do blind offers. Hey, I'm interested in buying your house. Well, now I'm in the appraisal business. I don't want to be in the appraisal business. So I'm going to get a 3 to 5% response rate on my offers. So you respond and say, hey, yeah, I'll take the $2,500 because for you, $2,500 is better than nothing. And again, in reality, 3 to 5% of people are going to accept my quote unquote top dollar offer. Now that you've accepted it, I have to go through due diligence or in-depth research. I have to confirm you still own the property. Back taxes are only $200. There's been no breaks in the chain of title. There's no liens or encumbrances. And so I'll outsource that work to my team in Jamaica. They're connected to an American title company. It costs about $11. If I was investing $5,000 or more, I would just close traditionally through an American title company. But let's assume everything checks out, which in 99% of the cases it does. And then I send you a check for $2,300, a check to the treasurer for $200. I own it free and clear. And then I'm going to sell it 30 days or less, and we make a cash flow like a rental home. So Brandon, I have a built-in best buyer. And I know you've read the book, so you know who it is?
The neighbors.
The neighbors, right. Exactly, the neighbors. So I sent out neighbor letters saying, here's your opportunity. Protect your privacy. Protect your views. Know your neighbor. If the neighbors pass, I'll go to my buyer's list. The buyer's list passes, I'll go to a website you probably heard of called Craigslist, 15th most trafficked
website
in the United States. yeah, exactly. Then I go to one called Meta or Facebook, the buy sell groups in the marketplace. And then I just go to the lands, land.com, landmoto.com, landandfarm.com, landsofamerica.com, landflip.com, landcentury.com, all these platforms where people buy and sell raw land. But the secret is the pricing. I'm going to make it irresistible. So I'm going to ask for a $2,500 down payment for someone to control that 5-acre parcel. And then I'll make it a car payment. Let's say $197 a month and 9% interest for the next 84 months. So it's a one-time sale. I get my money out on the down payment. I could go 6 to 10 months out. And now I'm getting $197 a month and 9% interest for the next 84 months. And again, no renters, no rehabs, no renovations, no rodents. And because I'm not dealing with a tenant, I'm exempt from Dodd-Frank, RESPA, and the SAFE Act, all this onerous real estate legislation. And so the way to become totally free to work when you want, where you want, with whom you want, is just have your passive income exceed your fixed expenses. And then you're going to move up Maslow's hierarchy of needs and to self-actualization and figure out what you really want to do in life.
Yeah, I love that. So I think another thing that you talk about in the book that's so, like, I love that you gave that 30,000 foot overview. I also want to kind of add on top of that with some of the other concepts you talk in the book that I would consider kind of like foundational concepts. Cause it's like anybody that has taken like, or just kind of heard just societally, we talk about, okay, you got to save up money, put it all in the stock market, and then you can eventually get like a 6% return. And once you get $5 million in your bank account, you can live off of that. So like maybe talk a little bit about anybody that like would compare and contrast that with your working on like some of the thoughts that you would have to encourage them to maybe think about either diversifying or leveraging more of a passive income investment solution like you're talking about.
Yeah. So let's talk about my buddy, Roberto Chavez. So Roberto lives in El Paso and he's a corporate attorney and he doesn't love it. Right. So as a side hustle, he starts investing in raw land. And in his first year of investing, he got to $10,000 a month in passive income. In his second year, I think it was like $14,000 a month. Third year, he got to $18,000 a month. Fourth year, like $25,000 a month. And once he got, I think, to like 18, he went from 5 days a week to 3 days a week, taking a day off and then another day to help his dad on his ranch. So now after 5 years, he's replaced, more than replaced his income. I think he's over like $30,000 a month now in passive. And so when I did the math with Roberto And I said, okay, Roberto, let's just take the $10,000 a month, right? And you're making $120,000 a year passive. So I got the calculator out. I'm like, $120,000. If we take a very aggressive 2% interest rate, you just, and you go to the bank and say, how much money do I need to deposit? And at 2%, it's going to give me $120,000 a year in interest. Your banker would say, no problem, $6 million. How long would it take the average person to save $6 million to throw off $120,000 a year in passive income? It wouldn't be 12 to 18 months.
100%.
For most people. Yeah. Maybe your listeners, but most people. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And like another thing I think is really important, and this is like your whole podcast. You got hundreds of episodes on this too. But like another thing that you talk about too is, you know, you can have a really high paying job, but like if you have solo economic dependency, like you're kind of like waiting for something to happen, especially if you're kind of, you got the golden handcuffs of just like a high income job, but you're, everybody's kind of tied to you. So maybe talk a little bit about that side of it as well, about the power of extracting your time from the income that you're making. And like if maybe just kind of turn some light switches on for some people that might realize that they're in a situation where we're leveraging some of this stuff might be really important for them to think about.
Yeah, I mean, my whole mission is to help people solve not just their money problems, but also their time problems. And so solo economic dependency means if you're personally not working, you're not making any money. So it could be, you know, someone with a W-2 job. It could be freelancers. We can pick on people that have solved their money problems, but not their time problems. Doctors, lawyers. Let's pick on the dentist. The dentist's hands aren't in the patient's mouth. The dentist isn't generating any revenue. So the only escape is passive income and doing that and starting with that. So to me, it's, you know, the way to sort of get that trifecta at the peak of your life, where we have money, time, and we have health, right? Because when we're young, we've got time and energy and health, but we have no money. In middle age, we've got money and we've got health, but we have no time. And when we're older, we've got money and time, but we don't have health. So this passive income gives us that trifecta of money, time, and health at the peak of our life to live our best lives.
Yeah. Love that. Awesome. Well, I mean, obviously you gave us like a really huge flyby, and I think people are probably like, obviously if somebody wants an in-depth, you can go check out Dirt Rich. Like I mentioned, we'll have that linked up in the show notes for people to kind of get the full breakdown. But I love too, that you gave like the 30,000 foot overview. So again, I was taking notes. If you're in the car, if you're on the treadmill, you got step one, find the sellers who no longer want their property. Step two, send out the top dollar offers to the people that you found in step one. Step three, analyze the deal. Step four, market the property on internet platforms that we talked about. And then step five is selling the property. So obviously it sounds like this is so easy. Just kidding. There's more that goes into this. Obviously you've boiled it down and you have a whole process around helping support people in doing this. But if I were to kind of zoom into one component of this, I think like, you know, it's passive income is really where you're working on the business, not inside of it, right? So I'm sure you can kind of do this all yourself. And you kind of mentioned like delegation and outsourcing and leveraging teams in other spots and having a system around it. I would love to maybe talk about the systematization component of what you've done, because I think that's really where you've really helped supported people in this process, is not only dialing this in, but also leveraging your resources to automate, to bring in people to help support it. So I think that's kind of like part of one of your powerhouse moves. And I saw one of your favorite words is automation. So I would love for you to maybe talk a little bit about how you went from figuring this out on your own to how you were able to kind of build this into a system that is not 100% dependent on you doing it, where it truly is passive for you now.
Yeah, no. Yeah. And if you're listening to this and I'm making it sound easy, it's not. In fact, if anyone makes anything sound easy, you know, it's not, right? Nothing worth doing is easy. So the model is simple, but it's certainly not easy. And there's lots of different pieces to it. And there is a learning curve to it. So yeah, at the overview, I'll make it sound really easy, but it's not. And it's very, it is, you know, more simple than other models. But I'm having coffee with my mentor, Ori. And Ori sold his company for $365 million to Experian. And I'm telling him, kind of humble bragging to him, Brandon, about, my business and how I'm doing these land deals. And I mentioned to him, about my business, and I'm telling him what I'm doing. He's like, "Mark, stop." He's like, "Don't insult me." I'm like, "What are you talking about?" He's like, "Don't call yourself an entrepreneur. Don't tell me you have a business." I'm like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "You just have a better job than what you had before." And I'm like, "What?" He's like, "Yeah, if you die tomorrow, where's your so-called business?" And he's like, "How are you going to take care of your family?" I'm like, he's like, "You're doing this, you're doing that." He's like, and actually, I remember Steve Jobs was alive at that time. He used that example. He's like, "If Steve Jobs dies, Apple will continue thriving." He's like, "An entrepreneur builds something bigger than themselves." So I'm like, "Well, how do I do that?" And he's kind of walked me through it. And I remember kicking and screaming. I'm like, "Well, no one's going to care as much as me. No one's going to do it as well as me." He's like, "Try it and see." And so step by step, I started getting out of each piece of the business and delegating. If after I would delegate, then I'd have a system, and then I could see, okay, where can I automate this? And so today, I mean, 90% of this business is automated with inexpensive virtual assistants, software, and on the front end, and then software on the back end, automating your note payments with a program called GeekPay.io. But it took me 5 years of doing this and learning how to grow and scale and get out of a business where today I teach it how to do it in 12 months. And my second book is actually Dirt Rich 2, How to Scale a Land Business. And I go really into the weeds on step by step on how to do that, what you should pay for people, where to find the people, what software you could use, and try to make it as evergreen as possible. Because if you're not using ChatGPT every day, or Claude or Bard or whatever it may be at the time, you're missing out on the greatest business opportunity in history. I mean, look, we should enjoy it now before the computers look at us like we look at, our dogs. But still, it's the best time to be alive.
100%. Yeah. No. And this is how I think Charles, shout out to Charles Bird, who connected the two of us. That was kind of like where he's like, "You guys need to talk about automation," which I think we need to continue that conversation. But there's so much to this process of like building out systems that I think for you who are you're probably at this point unconsciously competent at it, right? Like it is just a no-brainer. It's the air that you breathe and figuring out how to automate and delegate. So I want to double down on this as before we kind of start wrapping things up. So like if we have a friend that's listening that's like maybe just starting to realize, okay, I should systematize more, or maybe you have somebody that is further along that is looking kind of for that next level of systemization, like what are some of the lowest hanging fruits that you've identified over the years that have kind of helped you to take something from being a manual process to making sure that it's automated and systematized? Any kind of things that you would help and support people with on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people start, well, what should I systematize or automate or, do first? What do you hate doing the most in your business right now? That's the first thing you're going to start with. Then you do it, but you record yourself doing it. So you make a Loom video. Then you'll go to the AI and you'll have them just actually, take that video and make a standard operating procedure out of it. And then you'll edit that playbook and you'll have, someone younger than you or someone who knows nothing about the business run the playbook and ask, and then they're going to ask you questions. Then you're going to edit the playbook because you'll see, oh, this wasn't clear, that wasn't clear. And now you're done. You're out of it. And then you go to a site like hiremymom.com if you need someone American-based or upwork.com. But then you start using global talent. And then here's your playbook, run it. And now you're out of that piece of the business. And you do that again and again and again.
I'm currently on hiremymom.com. I've never heard of hiremymom.com. That's a new
There's
one for
so
me,
much
though. So
talent there.
but I do love Upwork. I've found some amazing talent on that. And too, yeah, no, I just want to like this is the you introduced the automation and ChatGPT and all that kind of stuff too in it. But like it is the SOP process of just opening up a Loom video, opening up a Vimeo video or whatever that you use in recording. And like, it's actually, I found that out of the box, you can pretty much ask ChatGPT to take a transcript and turn it into an SOP, and it's gonna get it 80% of the way there. So like, even that small little hack, like if you're worried about, oh, the process of creating an SOP, like if you can speak what the hell that you're doing, throw it into a transcription service, or most of this stuff is automatically transcribed, and dump it into ChatGPT and type out a half-assed prompt and say, can you turn this into an SOP? It's pretty damn close, right? And so like, I would highly recommend that people start doing that if you're not already, because that is super low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, absolutely. Write it in a fifth grade level, write this, you know, SOP, give it context. This is what we're doing. And it'll get you 80-85% of the way there. Then have them run the playbook and then edit it. And even better, have them edit it with you.
Yeah.
That's
something that I'm working on now. Better is instead of, because I'm transitioning from this is, I figured out how to do it, this is how to do it, and I'm trying to get better at now, this is the outcome that I'm looking for. I trust you and you know how to do this. Like, can you figure it out? Right. Like that's the kind of component that I'm working at streamlining as well. But like, any and all of this is just huge wins, especially like what you said, like, what do you not like the most? I mean, I can't tell you how many times this recommendation has come up, and not saying that it's not valid. Maybe this is the 300th time you've heard it and you haven't listened to it and you need to listen to it again. It's just like, make a list of the stuff that is giving you energy and not giving you energy. I've heard so many different variations of this exercise, and just start with those things that are draining with you. And like, I just game changer if you find a virtual assistant that can help and support you, and that you can just kind of start delegating some of that stuff off your plate, and just how much more for your mental sanity that can help. But then obviously you get to Mark's point where you have whole teams that can manage entire systems, and that's just it's just an amazing thing to look at.
Yeah, and if you're overwhelmed by the hiring process, I don't interview. I just have them run the playbook. I hire three people to run the playbook,
100%,
and then see who runs it the best, who improves it, who's that A player that cares the most and can think the most. And there's always do you have the 1-3-1 rule?
Explain it, because I have an idea, but I don't know if I have it 100% right.
I think this is the Dan Martell buy back your time philosophy. And so, you know, team member comes to you with a problem. You say, look, let's 1-3-1 rule it. So the 1-3-1 is, what's the problem you're trying to solve? Write that down. Then you come to me with three solutions on how you would solve that problem. And then you come to me with that one recommendation that you would come to me with and to solve that problem. 95% of the time, they don't come to you anymore, because like, they know, oh wait, I'm going to 1-3-1 it. And I remember this quote I heard is like, you don't get a dog and then teach it to bark.
100%. No, I love that too. And I find even that question, what's
or bark
you're trying
for
to solve?
Yeah, or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. So what's the problem you're trying to solve? Three solutions, one recommendation. I think like even that question, what problem you're trying to solve, I find that to be, going back to journaling, sometimes I'll just kind of feel like I'm stuck or unproductive. And like sometimes stopping and asking yourself, wait, what am I actually trying to solve for right now? It's like just a valuable thing in and of itself when you're caught in your head and you're trying to figure out all this other different stuff. So sometimes just pausing, you're asking yourself an effective question is magic in and of itself. So man, Mark, this has been so much fun, my friend. I know we talked about in the beginning, you had listen to a few other episodes or thought about the happiness question. So maybe I'll give them both to you, whatever you want to answer, Mark, as we kind of start wrapping up. And obviously we can find out more where people can find out about more, where they can check out your stuff, but would love to know either or both. What does happiness mean to you today? If we want to use an OG question, or how has curiosity impacted your life? We'd love to hear a little bit of both or one of them.
Yeah. So, okay. So let's start, cause I was thinking about the happiness thing.
Okay. Go for it.
And I was like, okay, I think it's very interesting, right? Like, I think that like, there's like this triple P template that I think leads to happiness. So you do something painful every day, get out of your comfort zone. You do something purposeful every day that feeds sort of your soul, and you do something that you're passionate about or gives you peace. Right. And I think that might be, I could be wrong, the template for happiness.
You come up with that? That's epic.
I was thinking about it.
P-cubed. Like, I like that. Mark's P-cubed formula for happiness. Painful, P-cubed. Purposeful, and passionate. I love that. That's great. Yeah. Wow. All right. Cool. Love that. Yeah. You want to take a crack at the curiosity question or add on to that? Whatever works for you.
Okay. So I think curiosity is the foundation and for living your best life. Because at the end of the day, I feel like I don't know anything about anything. Literally, I don't know anything about anything. And there is no top of the mountain. I'm constantly climbing. Yeah, I'll get tired. I'll go to base camp. I'll rest. But then there's more climbing. And that's in every aspect of my life that I just, curiosity is the antidote to everything. And I think that, you know, you're trapped by expertise, like people talk about, like in business, but it's even in relationship where I'm, you know, in a conversation with somebody that I've been friends with for 25 years or, you know, my partner, and she's talking to me and I'm no longer curious because, like, I know what she's going to say because I think I know her so well. And as soon as I become more curious and I ask more questions, everything deepens. And there's always that other onion to peel. And people, you know, either hate going out to dinner with me or love going out to dinner with me, because I will always be so curious about them. And I want to get to that, you know, I really want to connect with them in the curiosity. And so I had a question for you.
Ooh, all right. I'll take it.
Okay. So finish the sentence. The most important thing in life is?
Let me take a second and sit with that for a second. The most important thing in life is? I'm gonna not overthink it. I'm gonna say, I feel like it has to be presence, like some element of just being fully in your body and knowing who you are and being in the moment. So I that wasn't an answer. That was a terrible answer. Let me try again.
No, it's not a terrible answer. I love that answer. I think what you're trying to say is maybe peace or silence.
Yeah, I think to me it's like alignment. Alignment is such an important thing. Like alignment in the moment, alignment with who you are in your life, alignment with your relationships, right? And like I think alignment's a kind of the word, but like you could also use connection as a synonym for that as well. But I think at the end of the day, if you keep asking, like if you start with that question, you keep asking why layers back. I did this with somebody that's coming on the show later, Dove Barron, but he kind of did this with me, and you keep going back a layer and layer. And eventually you kind of realize that, like, at the core of all of it is just like consciousness, like pure consciousness, like you just being ridiculously present and connected and peaceful and all the things. Right. And so like, that's my terrible non-succinct response, but there we go.
So you're the second person that I've asked that answered that way.
Okay.
And it is my favorite answer. Most people I ask that will answer love, health, happiness, family, God, faith. And I thought love. But I had a buddy of mine answer it, and he said what you said, which is basically, you know, silence or peace or presence. And I'm like, well, tell me, say more. And he was just saying, like, you know, love can make you crazy. Your family can make you crazy. And anything in life can make you crazy. Like, it can disrupt that peace of mind. And so if you have that, then every moment is the best moment.
Yeah.
And then it can stem from there. So you can enjoy your family. You can enjoy the love and relationships. You can go deeper into your spirituality and know that at a deep, peaceful level, like you're enough. You're okay. Like you're, you know, it's there. It's that ineffable silence, if you will.
Yeah.
Like that,
like
pure
just living,
consciousness.
living every moment. Like it's the best moment of your life. I think I heard Hal Elrod share that initially. I'm like, this is just so damn true. Like, how is this not the best moment of our entire life right now? Like just hanging out with me and you, but then I'm going to go and I'm going to give my wife a hug after this. And that's going to be the best moment of my whole life. And then I'm going to give my daughter a kiss. And like, that's going to be the best moment of my whole life. Right. So like, if all we ever have is the present moment, you might as well treat every single moment as the best moment of your life. You know, it's like, I love that.
Yeah. It's so hard to do. And I if I'm doing the dishes or if I'm doing laundry, I consciously think that and go deeper into that, these very simple things. And they're so enjoyable now.
Yeah. That's beautiful. Yeah. Awesome. Well, Mark, you were the first ever person to answer both the curiosity and the happiness question. And we just got to go really deep. So I love that. That was a ton of fun. Thanks for playing along there. And I want to be respectful of your time. And I know we're kind of wrapping up here, but obviously we've talked a little bit about your book, Dirt Rich. People can go check that out if they want to find out more about the land investing and kind of get your whole philosophy and your whole system. You got a podcast. Talk to us a little bit about where we can find about you and your journey.
Yeah. So I think the best place to go is thelandgeek.com. And then I'll have a link for your listeners to get the book for free. They just have to pay for shipping. So I'll give you that. And then, I mean, that's the two best places to learn more.
All right. Yeah. Go to landgeek.com. We'll have whatever link that you give me linked up in the show notes. And, just going to really quickly have a conversation with you listening right now. And I'll tie it into what we just said at the end, but it's like, you could be present in so many other places, but you chose to be present in this moment right now. And you're still listening, which means that we've said something interesting today. And for that, we're very grateful for you being a part of this conversation. And, I just know that something in this episode, multiple things in this episode, could absolutely transform someone's life. And I say this at the end of every episode, but I don't get sick of saying it because it's so true. And this is why I'm a podcaster. I'm sure it's part of why you're a podcaster as well, Mark. It's like these stories that, like, you never know what one thing you're going to hear that's really going to just make a profound shift in your perspective, or maybe just give you the power to go through a different moment. So maybe it was that story in the very beginning of organic baby food, and maybe you resonated with that. Or maybe it was the stories later about just the gum and overcoming the negative mental blocks, or just kind of hearing Mark's crazy journey of just being able to turn this into an entire system and crashing after having a lavish lifestyle and realizing what really matters. There's so much in here that could absolutely shift someone's perspective. So my ask is that you just take a second, you think of one friend. Who's that one friend that maybe they're into real estate, or maybe they're into presence, or maybe they're into some topic that we're talking about today, and you just share this with that one person. You have no idea the impact that this can make. It would make my day. I know it would make Mark's day as well. But whether you choose to do that or not, I appreciate you for being here, my friend. And Mark, any final things you want to say before we head off today?
No, Brandon, this was a pure delight. And you are a gem of a human being and a phenomenal podcast host. And you know, now I've got to, you know, there's a great saying, like, comparison's the thief of happiness. So now I've got to up my podcast game and emulate you.
Oh, thanks, brother. I really appreciate it. It has been a joy. I was looking forward to this, and thank you for the delightful conversation. And I'm going to take you up on a dinner or lunch or at some point whenever we meet up, and I will submit myself to whatever questioning you want to ask, and we can both go deep. It'll be good. I know I'd enjoy it. So I appreciate you, Mark. We'll talk to you soon, brother.